and I'm your brother, Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now, the definition.
History entertains us with the stories of Roman empires, the territorial tales of the Ottoman Empire, and the swashbuckling British Empire. But what about the Americans' imprint on the world? Although not really an empire in the traditional sense, Americans have left an imprint of culture, influence, and global economics around the world. Most, if not all, countries have a section of society who will take pride in their nationalism. In Thailand, all citizens stand still in public twice a day to respect the monarch. Indians have a high sense of national pride, with over 40% of her citizens believing she is the best country in the world. The Brits are still vocal about their past empire and World War victories, but when it comes to national pride, the good old USA just seems to have the edge. Today we find out why, in this episode of the Infographic Show, do Americans feel they are superior to everybody else? The United States is proud of its past, but shouldn't most countries be super proud of their past achievements? When it comes to achievements and inventions, the United States is no mere two-bit player on the world stage. The moon landing is not to be sneezed at, and the auto industry was a major industrial shot in the arm that has been replicated across the world. Then we have the invention of the worldwide omnipresent cell phone, the less visible submarine, and let's not forget the world's first nuclear reactor, all US projects and inventions. The PC and tech revolution that's taken the world by storm is largely American, not to mention the internet, without which you probably wouldn't be watching this video right now. All this was achieved in a relatively short space of time, following America's involvement in World War II, a war that was crucial in helping to achieve an Allied victory, crushing the Axis powers, and giving birth to the new world as we know it. National pride, or patriotism, is love and devotion to one's country, and a sense of alliance with other citizens who share the same values. In the United States and other larger countries such as Russia and China, national pride has a deep dimension. Each negative event that happens against the nation can reinforce a love for the country. Men and women every day from all nations do not hesitate to join the army and to prove their national pride with the business end of a semi-automatic rifle, and not always in a conflict that they fully understand. Americans, however, aren't always so fast to sign up for the war effort. In 1964, American citizens took a stand against their country's involvement in the Vietnam War, demonstrating against the government in what became a broad social civil liberties movement. Many of those within the peace movement were students, moms, or anti-establishment hippies. Opposition grew with African-American civil rights, women's liberation, and other marginalized sectors of the community who all considered American involvement in Vietnam to be a mistake, a view echoed decades later by U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. It has been said that Americans don't travel overseas much, and according to the Huffington Post in a 2012 article, only 3.5% of Americans travel abroad, although they do not take lots of domestic holidays, and who can blame them with such a vast country to visit? Is it any wonder that when Americans do leave the States, they have a somewhat inflated opinion of their home country and therefore feel superior to some of the places they travel to, and therefore leave the impression that they have a national superiority complex? But not all Americans feel their country is superior. Although there are no true reliable figures, a 1999 State Department estimate suggests that there are between 3 and 6 million Americans living outside of the United States. The countries most visited by Americans include Germany, Italy, France, and the United Kingdom. A certain brand of travel known as genealogy tourism is undertaken by Americans, whereby they travel to Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Germany, or wherever they have traced their ancestors to, and this type of travel is typically, by definition, of a respectful nature. Those who travel to the countries of their ancestors, and there are many Americans who do so, cannot be totally driven by a nationality bias. So on that basis, Americans aren't snobby travelers. According to an academic study on American superiority by Tappan, Ryan, and McKay, most Americans strongly believe they are virtuous and moral. Yet they regard the average person as distinctly less so. In the study, participants judged themselves and the average person on traits reflecting the core dimensions of social perception, morality, and agency, and found themselves distinctly better qualified than the next person. It should be noted that in this study, Americans were judging themselves against predominantly other Americans. However, the sense of overall judgment without doubt travels fondly overseas. National pride also seems to be a generational phenomenon, with the older generations being more nationalistic than the younger generations. As younger generations tend to travel, and the gap year among students becomes more popular, national pride does seem to be quietly fading among Americans. The more we travel around the world and experience different cultures, the less nationalistic we are, as national pride is often deeply rooted in the ignorance of other countries and cultures. It is basic human behavior that we fear what we don't know, and we accept and admire what we recognize and understand. But with that said, a little national pride is nothing to worry about, provided it doesn't go overboard.
All this week, we have been amusing ourselves because we're cheap. We can't go to the movies or Broadway plays like you rich folks can. So we amuse ourselves by re-listening to all of the There Is Definitely Going to Be a Government Shutdown coverage, which is hilarious, which is followed by What a Savvy Operator Kevin Is Turning Out to Be coverage, followed by the Well, sure, Kevin went on the Sunday shows to talk about lie by Democrats who just saved his life, but that's just politics coverage. Which is followed by, you know, Matt Gaetz is a clown, but a dangerous clown. However, if Kevin can cut another deal with Democrats, he can probably survive at the end of the week. All that coverage we listened to back to back to back. And all of these storylines were stenographed straight from Kevin McCarthy's office.
That's right. That's right. I don't know what Axios is going to do now that they don't have Kevin McCarthy to tell them what to write. Which brings us to this week's other big story, which is also stenoed from Kevin McCarthy's office. And please don't forget that the Washington, D.C. media is a very lazy bunch.
So lazy. So lazy.
So this storyline is why Democrats are so irresponsible that they shirked their sacred duty to save Kevin McCarthy's career.
Mm-hmm.
Bad Democrats.
It's right there in the platform every 4 years, the Democratic Party.
They have to bail out the Republican Party and save them. Right.
Yep.
And this is the joke that Driftglass wrote many, many years ago, back 20. In the Cokie Roberts days of this week, ABC's This Week. And we've been telling this joke in various forms, right, for 20 years. And the joke goes like this. Dick Cheney is caught on camera on the White House lawn throwing burning kittens at homeless veterans. What are the first three words out of Cokie Roberts or David Gregory's or Chuck Todd's mouth?
Mm-hmm.
But the Democrats.
Every time.
Every time. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't have found a better real-time example of how baked in this mindset is than the reactions to Kevin McCarthy getting fired by Republicans.
By Republicans. The bear trap that they created for themselves, that he stepped into. And I will precede this with a little story about a dog they used to have, my brother and I and my family, named Mahal, who's a sweet little dog. And we used to walk Mahal in the field next to our house. Great dog, great travel dog, etc. But every now and then, because I was a bit of a bastard, I would confuse Mahal. Because to walk her, I would basically stand in the middle of what was a circle and with my arm extended and walk her in a great circle around me. Very simple. Stand in one place pretty much and walk her in a great arc around me. But every now and then, I would cut in front of her and try to be the guy on the outside of the circle while she was on the inside of the circle. And Mahal would be completely confused, would not know what to do, because Mahal only knew one way to do walkies. And that was with me in the middle and her on the end of the leash walking in a circle. And that's what happened this week. Mm-hmm. Republicans do not know how to function. The mainstream media does not know how to cope with the fact the Democrats finally said, "Fuck it, this is your problem, you fix it," and walked away from Kevin McCarthy. So let's start with George Bush's very own Baghdad Bob, a guy named Ari Fleischer, who I'm sure most of you remember, quote, "Unmentioned in the vote to dump the speaker is the role the D's in the so-called problem solver caucus played. Yesterday could have been their big moment, and they were useless. They didn't solve a problem. They were mere partisans. There are no problem solvers in Congress," unquote. He's very
God
angry.
Forbid Democrats should be partisan.
Yeah, vote for Democrats. Because I remember all those votes the Republicans offered up for Nancy Pelosi. Also, This is also Ari Fleischer. "Unbelievable. The Democrats, with the help of Matt Gaetz and a handful of GOP members, just ousted the Republican Speaker of the House. What a mess. This is so foolish. Why would anyone want to be Speaker of the House?" Unquote. Well, you know what? Nancy Pelosi was Speaker for a good long time and never had this problem. You wonder why?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a point where I can insert the fact that Speaker of the House is a job.
Yeah, a real job.
It's a real job with some good, fun things to do. You certainly have a lot of power. You're third in line to the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
But you are also the personnel department for House Republicans, if you're a Republican speaker.
Yes, you are.
You're also the payroll department in terms of doling out Republican Congressional Campaign Committee money.
Mm-hmm.
And fundraising for that campaign committee.
Uh-huh.
And dealing with things like George Santos. And a lot of messy problems. Like if a congressperson starts to get a lot of postcards about a bridge in his district or a post office that needs renaming or anything, it's not the member who goes before the Congress and says, "I have this problem, please help me fix it." He goes to the speaker.
Right.
And the speaker says, "Yes, okay, you have this problem. You keep getting all these letters from your constituents. They're mad about something very local, but something that the federal government can help with. Let's get two other people from your area and you guys put together a bill. I'll assign it to committee. We'll get it onto the floor." And and the speaker and the whip and the House leadership are the people that navigate that bill, whether it gets folded into another bill or an omnibus bill or a Defense Department bill, a lot of things get put in there. They're the ones, the House leadership is the ones that have to decide all that. Mm-hmm. And Nancy Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries, as is following Nancy Pelosi, are very good at this.
Yes, they are. Very good.
They're very good at putting people on committees.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned last week, Hakeem Jeffries put these heavy hitters on the impeachment committee. Yeah. And a lot of them are former prosecutors, so they know what they're doing when they get into a situation where some witness is trying to bring up absolutely no evidence whatsoever. They know how to hammer that down. They also know an awful lot about parliamentary procedure.
Yes, they do.
And they were able to really tie Jim Comer in knots, to waste time, to make the... Oh, I'm sorry, there's a motion on the floor. No, wait, there's another motion on the floor. No, you have to table that motion before we can do this. And it just wasted time after time after time while Jim Comer was trying to say, we want to impeach the president because... And reasons. Oh, we don't have any reasons. Yeah. Okay.
Well, and they made them look foolish. It wasn't just strategically burning the clock. It was, you made the Republican Party, who this is their premier issue. This is the one thing that they want to get done.
And they fought for this.
Look like the idiots that they are. They're completely incompetent. And
well, they wanted another Benghazi. They wanted to have televised hearings. Providing content for Fox News is what they perceive to be their job.
And welcome to Hannity History on Capitol Hill tonight. 8 Republican lawmakers joining all 208 House Democrats to remove Kevin McCarthy as House Speaker. The first time in our nation's history. And McCarthy will not seek the speakership again. Now, sources telling me at this hour, some House Republicans have been in contact with and have started an effort to draft former President Donald Trump to be the next speaker. And I have been told that President Trump might be open to helping the Republican Party, at least in the short term, if necessary, if it's needed. Anyway, but here's former Speaker McCarthy earlier tonight. Let's take a look.
I believe I can continue to fight, maybe in a different manner. I will not run for speaker again. I'll have the conference pick somebody else. I think today was a political decision by the Democrats. And I think the things they have done in the past hurt the institution. When they just started removing people from committee, and they just started doing the other things. And my fear is the institution fell today. Because you can't do the job if 8 people, you have 94% of, or 96% of your entire conference, but 8 people can partner with the whole other side. How do you govern? And for them to make a motion on me because I made a decision for the country that they agreed with, but they choose to do the other, that becomes a problem. Yeah.
Now, this all went down after a motion to vacate was put forward by Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, citing trust issues because of a recent bipartisan resolution, a CR, to fund the government through mid-November and a lack of action on a number of bills, appropriations bills. And Gaetz went forward with a move to oust Speaker McCarthy. Successful. Anyway, given the slim GOP majority, Gaetz needed only a handful of other Republicans to get it done. But now uncertainty reigns supreme on Capitol Hill. In truth, Gaetz, other Republicans, they did have legitimate complaints. Returning to regular order, passing appropriations bills, single issue bills, balanced budget amendment, term limits, all promised fair criticism. But many of those measures could have been dealt with, especially in the future, especially issues that would never have become law at this time. Really came down to the fiscal issues in play here, the appropriations process, for example. But the question is this, and every conservative, every Republican needs to be asking this tonight, was this the best strategic and tactical approach at this moment? Now, there were very, very viable alternatives, plans put together by Freedom Caucus members, people like Congressman Chip Roy, who will join us tonight, and Byron Donalds and Scott Perry. For example, one plan cut from them cut spending by a whopping 8% and also had historic border security measures attached, but was opposed by Gaetz and a few other Republicans, and that didn't go far. That left Chip Roy kind of speechless. That plan would have allowed more time needed for the appropriations bills to be passed. And the second option actually had a 30% cut in discretionary spending and included, by the way, the Republican Party's border bill, H.R. 2. That would have been a great alternative. That, again, would have also resulted in the full 12 appropriations bills having been voted on and hopefully passed. So today, the question we all have, was the nuclear option needed? Was it worth it? Well, I can tell you right now, I don't know. Time will certainly tell whether this is a good move or a bad move. But one reality will not change. Republicans have a minuscule majority, whoever the speaker is, and it is made up of disparate groups ranging from moderate left to Freedom Caucus conservative. Now, Gates says that he was ripping the Band-Aid off the status quo in the Washington swamp. But the House Oversight Committee Chairman Jim Jordan had a different take. Let's hear him.
On January 3rd, we said the 118th Congress is about three things. Pass the bills that need passed, do the oversight work that needs to be done, and stop the inevitable omnibus that comes from the United States Senate right before the holidays. Kevin McCarthy has been rock solid on all three. We have passed the bills we told the American people we would pass. 87,000 IRS agents, that bill passed. Parents' Bill of Rights, that bill passed. Energy legislation passed. Border security, immigration enforcement legislation, the strongest bill ever to pass the Congress, passed earlier this year. We have done what we told them we were going to do.
All right. Now, keep in mind, Republicans hold a 9-vote majority and 1/2 of 1/3 of the federal government. Making up that very slim majority is a coalition of lawmakers. You got the Freedom Caucus, the Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Sunday group, the study group, along with moderate Republicans, many from districts that Biden won in 2020, 18 to be exact. Now, bringing that group together on anything is not an easy feat. But in the end, Republicans, let me warn you tonight, you will succeed or you will fail together. That is undeniable. Still, McCarthy accomplished a lot, including a serious investigation into Biden's bribery, money laundering allegations, which is ongoing, an impeachment inquiry that is now picking up steam, an investigation into Biden's weaponized FBI and DOJ, multiple major pieces of legislation, including a border security bill that I just mentioned, a bill to stop Biden's plan to hire 80,000 new IRS agents, a bill to stop big government restrictions on gas stoves and other appliances, another bill to repeal the worst parts of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But now, without a speaker, all matters involving the House come to a grinding halt. The GOP's investigations will be stalled. Zero Republican bills will be sent to the Senate. And Republican infighting, that'll take center stage, which is exactly what Democrats and the media mob desperately want, and they want to continue for a long period of time. Now, President Trump earlier today, even in the midst of what's going on in New York, took time to post this on Truth Social. Why is it that Republicans are always fighting among themselves? Why aren't they fighting the radical left Democrats who are destroying our country? Oh, I happen to agree with the president. We are now a year away from the single most pivotal election of our lifetime. It's all on the line now. Democrats are destroying the rule of law. Equal justice, equal application of our laws is dead. And by the way, as we've seen, Donald Trump and his family are now being targeted in ways this country has never seen before. Joe Biden and his family are shielded, protected around every turn by Joe's weaponized DOJ. The border is an absolute disaster, nightmare, national security risk. Our economy is a disaster. Americans are suffering more than at any point in my lifetime. Inflation is through the roof. Gas prices are through the roof and going higher, by the way. And our commander-in-chief has real significant cognitive issues that everybody in the world can see because it's that transparent. He is neither physically nor mentally fit to serve this country. House Republicans can't solve their differences behind closed doors. How about you get in a room, you throw away your phone, and maybe you stay in that room, order pizza, and don't come out until you agree. Knowing how important these appropriations bills were, I have a criticism. Why did the Republicans take off the month of August? In the end, this may all turn out fine. I'm not hitting the panic button tonight. However, the American people's patience, it will run out quickly here. And so the GOP, take my advice if you want. It seems a lot of people never take it. Be careful, and you better get a new speaker quickly. Democrats, they want you in complete disarray. They want a distraction away from their failed policies and their feeble president. And they'd really love a few moderate Republicans to peel off and actually vote for a Democrat for speaker. So will the GOP rally behind a new speaker? Will anyone even want the job? Or will this end in a disaster? I cannot answer that question tonight, but time will tell. We'll be right back.
between the government shutdown and now this motion to vacate the speakership, it is enough to, you know, just make you swear off politicians altogether, but specifically Republicans. Like, you've got to really hate your life and or women to vote Republican at this late date, understanding that Republicans, all they want to do is grandstand to sell you like a podcast, which honestly, that's my job. That's comedian slash podcaster's job, not Congress people's job. So I am about not everything, not just everything that went down with the shutdown, which, as we know, was averted narrowly thanks to Democrats who stepped in to help Speaker Kevin McCarthy. That's actually a reason why Republicans are mad right now. We've got 45 more days to fund the government, so y'all visit your local library, okay? Let's go with the fat bear contest. Come on now, go to a national park in the next 45 days, because who knows if there will be any staff left in a month and a half. But not only... it's not just Matt Gaetz, because Matt Gaetz is the representative that basically was, you know, okay, let's time out. It's not just Republicans that were like, we're going to defund the entire education department because books. Like, you know, that didn't pass. Nothing passed. They got a clean bill through. But now Matt Gaetz is like, This isn't about me enough. And so he's called a vote of no confidence, or a vacation vote. It's basically you send McCarthy on vacation. No, it's a motion to vacate the speakership position, which if they successfully do and then are unable to replace him with someone, anyone really, the entire House actually also shuts down. Because let's be real. These folks that are, they're deeply unserious people, as Logan Roy would say. They got elected to absolutely do nothing. All right? This is, we've elected termites to wooden house people. That's right. That's my metaphor. I'm going with it. And we're like, what did we expect? What do we expect? Well, I don't know. I think they're going to really quell their appetite. You know, they've lost the taste for wood. No. That's the whole point. They get inside and they destroy it from the inside. And the best part, the thing that I'm bitching about, which is so funny to me, two things. First of all, the people like Matt Gaetz, Andy Biggs, the ones who want Kevin McCarthy, they think he's a centrist. They think he's giving Joe Biden all his budget. And it's like, oh my God, you guys have the power. And what are you doing with you? He's trying to impeach Biden for you. He did that for you. And you're ungrateful. You're going to still try and remove him. How dare you? But anyway, the best part of it is you've got two types of Republicans. They're basically the same, but a bunch of the Republicans who don't like Kevin McCarthy are insurrectionists. They were the ones who were supporting, aiding, abetting, giving comfort to, and whatever the hell else it says in the Article 14 of the Constitution, that they were trying to overthrow the government in 2020. They're still there. Andy Biggs, he's still there. Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Greene, these MFers are still there now being like, look, so I know we tried to shut everything down the like violent way or whatever. Now we want to do it the procedural way. So suddenly they're still there. Secondly, they're going on and on about spending. Like, oh, the trillions of dollars. But they won't tell you what they want to cut, because what they want to cut is Medicaid, Medicare for old people. They want to cut funding to the IRS, which is literally bringing in cash. But it's bringing in cash from who? From rich people. That's why. Right. They they're so bald faced with this now. And so I think it's very fun to watch someone like Pramila Jayapal say this in regards to the vote to remove Speaker McCarthy and whether or not Democrats are going to come to the rescue here. And in fact, Hakeem Jeffries, minority speaker in the House, gave the bat signal that was basically like, nah, don't help these don't help them. So here is here's Pramila. On what she thinks the Democratic strategy should be in all of this Republican noise.
just let Republicans deal with their own problems. I mean, they can let them wallow in their pigsty of incompetence and inability to govern. This
let them wallow in their pigsty of incompetence.
I love that. And look, and this is the thing, is that Republicans don't actually want to be in leadership positions. They're not comfortable in it. They like being in the opposition. They all have like beleaguered martyr, you know, they want to be in the minority. They're jealous of minorities, you know? And so now if they can be a minority in the House, then they could be like, oh my God, you're not including us, you know, like we're oppressed. You know what I mean? Like they love being oppressed. They're obsessed with being oppressed. But when they're on top, when they're in control, they don't know what to do. They don't have any rule. They don't have any vision. And all the Republicans that are like, this is bad. You know, we shouldn't do this. They're just going up there and be like, you know, King David said in the Bible, skibbidi-bop-boop-be, I love Kim McCarthy. Like they're making as little sense as possible. It's very funny. It's like nobody knows the doing. Meanwhile, we got Karen up here, the woman taking the roll call. She's fucking hilarious. She got the most Karen haircut I've ever seen. I thought I knew her name at some point, but if anyone knows it, you know, shout her out. I'll send her a free for Antifa t-shirt. But that's what I'm bitching about. These motherfuckers are so unserious. They're so ridiculous. Matt Gaetz is doing this because he's got an ethics investigation, not only into sexual assault, potential trafficking, drug use, sharing inappropriate images or videos on the House floor, misusing state ID records, one more thing that I just wrote down is converting, which clearly there was more to that, but it sounds bad. He was basically trying to convert people to his, you know, Matt Gaetzian religion, obviously.
Storm is rising against a privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. This freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Vimir Dees. Oh, God, yeah. And welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. You know, I can't even call this an emergency episode. First and foremost, because it's coming out too late to be an emergency episode. But I have the time to record it, so I'm going to record it. We need this, the title of this show, this episode, is we need to stop calling conservatives radicals. They are regressives. They are extremists. They are nihilists, not radicals. Huge difference. For the first time in American history, or say I've seen both actually reported, for the first time in American history, and then another one said first time in over 100 years, but let's just say for the first time in living memory, a party in the majority has kicked its speaker to the curve. Even if this hasn't happened for over 100 years, it's still stunning. It's still stunning. In watching it in real time, the look on McCarthy's face as he said the chair is now vacant was telling. He thought the Democrats were going to save him. He thought the Democrats were going to save the Republicans. He thought that, even though he lied several times, that people would think that he was just playing politics and that ultimately he was going to become sensible at the last moment and do what was right. Though he was playing a lot of games. He figured he could play the games and people would put up with him because, well, that's just how power works. He found out wrong. He found out he was wrong. That is how power works in his mind. That is how power works in the mind of the MAGA, of the MAGA bots, of the Tea Partiers. I was listening to Hal Sparks. I don't listen to him often, and I appreciate his show when I do get to actually listen to it, especially live. And he was pointing out that, you know, the reason this took place was because of Trump and that this could really be traced back to Trump. I'm sorry, Mr. Sparks, but you're wrong. You're incorrect. This actually can be traced farther back than Trump. I mean, I could be really nice and I could say the Tea Partiers, but if I really want to tell the truth, I have to go back to Gingrich's tenure as Speaker of the House when the Republicans took back the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. Speaker of the House, first time in 40 years they took it back. I want y'all to think about that. I also want you to think about what has occurred to this country since they took it back for the first time in 40 years. I want you to think about what occurred in the 40 years prior to them taking control. Then I want you to think about what's occurred since they took back control for the first time in 40 years of the House of Representatives, and I want you to do a side-by-side comparison. If you're not young enough to answer this question, to say this is what happened during the 40 years the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives, this is what has happened since the Republicans have been able to take it back multiple times throughout multiple decades since the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for 40 years. If you're too young, do some research. Do some research. Now look, it wasn't all sunshines and rainbows with the Democrats holding control of the House of Representatives. But government worked. Government worked. And I didn't realize this. Prior to 1994-95, the government had technically shut down multiple times because there was some law passed in the 1970s that stipulated a budget had to be passed or else the government would shut down. There was some law that was passed. Technically, the Democrats failed to pass a budget on time multiple times prior to the most famous one that we all remember, which was in the 1994-1995, first one. But saying that they failed to pass a budget really does it some disservice because, one, typically, it was the budget was passed either hours later or a few days later. They would actually typically pass CRs to keep the government running so, you know, nobody would notice that the government was actually shut down. There wasn't, in other words, There was no ideological difference, per se. They were just ironing out the details. So since there was no ideological difference, and since people weren't actually arguing if government should exist, which is what a lot of conservatives argue, that government shouldn't exist other than intelligence, military, police state apparatus, and maybe a few regulatory agents that we have to have to keep the police and the military straight. They weren't arguing about that stuff. They were focused on the details. What was going to actually go into the budget and how is it going to work for the society? That can take some time. Especially in eras, when travel was still a little time consuming. People didn't realize that the government almost shut down because the Democrats were very good at continuity, so people wouldn't notice. Now, when Ronald Reagan came in, and there was a few times during his tenure when the government technically shut down, then you had ideological difference. But still, even Ronald Reagan, as much as I think as terrible as a president he was, the fact that he didn't know that he was even, not playing a part for the last 3 years of his life because his brain was turning to mush in real time. No disrespect intended. Or maybe a disrespect intended. But even he was about the continuity of government. Government should not be 100% done away with. What of today? Today, you have the two minds of the Republic clashing. You have those who believe that government should be destroyed, no matter how much it benefits or it helps ease the stresses of daily life for ordinary people. And you have folks who believe that government can do good and must do good, and that if it is going to do good, it must do common good. It must ease the suffering of the masses. It must provide the foundation, the basis for life. If you want to talk about an even playing field, all these conservatives like to talk about opportunities. You have the opportunity to do this, that, that, and this. Opportunity means nothing if you were born hanging off of a cliff with somebody who's constantly throwing rocks and mud and dirt down upon you as you try to climb up to get started in life. Government wants to make sure that you're not on that cliff when you're born. With two competing ideologies, the Federalists, the real Federalists, the ones who actually think there should be a federal government, and the Anti-Federalists, those who think there should not be a federal government, or a very small, quote, limited federal government, meaning a federal government that mirrors the type of government, the federal government the United States had in the early 1800s and the late 1800s. It was very weak. It was very inefficient, and corporations ran all over it, and literally, in many areas of the country, ran it. With those two mindsets clashing again, what you end up with is skewed priorities when it comes to budgeting, especially when the anti-federalists take over Congress, particularly the House of Representatives. If they do not believe that the federal government should exist, and they do believe that the federal government should not exist, their budgetary priorities are going to be dedicated to killing those portions of the federal government that they believe should not exist. Hence the need, the desire, the demand to drastically cut domestic spending, what they call entitlement spending. I have an episode coming out, or actually, no, I apologize. I already released the episode on entitlements. You should listen to it. They want to kill the government because they do not fundamentally believe in the federal government. Yet these are the same people running around talking about how patriotic they are to this thing called the United States of America, which only exists thanks to the federal aspect of it. If the federal government did not exist, I guarantee you the portions of the Confederacy would band together and try to take over the North. Why? Because ultimately, the majority of those states need the resources, need the financing, need the money from the North and the West. They need it. But that's for another show. You're dealing with a strain of conservatism that is nihilistic at heart. And because it is nihilistic, it tears up institutions, both hardened institutions, meaning those institutions that are in buildings, and those things that are traditionally institutional, that are through rules and regulations and concepts that are written down on paper. They tear that stuff up because they are destructive. It's funny, years ago, when all this talk of austerity was the rage within the Republican Party, these people are always about austerity, except when it comes to military and corporate corporate welfare. Everything else needs austerity except for those two things. When austerity was their clarion call, I decided that I would do a little bit of research into what it meant. And it's funny how, when you go back far enough, austerity has a separation quality to it when it comes to its definition. It is about ripping things from other things. That's what austerity is about when you go back far enough into its origins and its history and its meaning. It's about ripping something off of something else. It's about detaching something off of something else. This is nihilism. It is the nihilist defined in the 1900s, particularly the mid-1900s. See, the reason I keep bringing this up, the reason I keep saying these folks are not radical, we need to call them exactly what they are, because you don't name a thing, you can't defeat it. They are fascists, yes, but they're not radicals. They're not radicals. They are fascists, yes, but they are nihilists. They are nihilists. There is nothing radical about a fascist. And by the way, in case you think that I'm just making this up, Hitler talked about this. Oh, wait, you're going to cite Hitler? Hitler knew what he was. Yes, I'm citing him. He said it. We're not like the radicals. We're not like the socialists. We're not like the communists. We're not like all of these things that you call left, because that's what radicalism is. It's on the left. All the things that you call left, Hitler was clear about. We are not like them. Mussolini was clear about. We are not like them. We are not. We are traditionalists, which is primarily a right-wing conservative concept. We are taking from the old, infusing that which has gone away, infusing that which we can still grasp from the past, and we are using it to infuse and build a new future. That's what he said. We have to call these people by who they really are. They are regressives. They are nihilists. They are destroyers. They are deconstructors. They are people who are involved in counter-revolutionary measures. They do not bring revolution. They bring devolution. As a black man, I've seen it happen. I've witnessed it. My own father told me, you better not believe what they tell you about the Klan, because who they tell you the Klan is only a snap, is not on, I'm sorry, not a snapshot, but is only a pinch of who they really are. What they tell you to call them, you better learn to call them something else, because they will not tell you the whole story of who they are. These people terrorized us. They tried destroying everything we built. And they did it because they felt like they had a God-given right to do so. Sound familiar? People don't talk about it. The Klan were evangelicals, most of them. Yeah, some of them were Protestants. Some of them were Methodists. But they believed that they had a God-given right to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ to everybody who would listen to them, and even to those who wouldn't. They also believed that black people were less than them, and God told them that that's the truth. It's funny because they get that out of the Talmud, which I don't know if they know what the Talmud is and where it comes from, but that kind of throws a whole wrench into their whole anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish thing, doesn't it? Anyway, I digress. This is where I get my fiery interpretation of who these people are, because I see the correlations, I see the connections, I see how one group influences another and the other influences the other. I see how the institutions are being twisted and manipulated and coerced by these folks. And I'm trying to get you to see it. You're not talking about radicals here, you're talking about regressives. You're talking about, and this is a weird thing to call them, but when you look at the definition of this word, apart from its biological usage, it fits. These people are antigens. They are meant to stimulate the defenses of the body and to interact with the body in a destructive way, which makes them nihilists. A nihilist destroys political institutions in order to prepare them to be built better, or so they say. They're dedicated to destruction ultimately. They don't know nothing about actual building. That's not what they do. Progressives are different. Progressives can destroy institutions, but they are primarily focused on reforming, restructuring. Do you know what radicals do? Radicals destroy, but they always have their eyes focused on reconstruction, building something new in place of that which is destroyed. A radical understands that there is time for reformation, but even in their reforming, there is a form of destruction. Even in their reforming, there is a form of destruction. And when they are done destroying, they always build back better. They always build back better. They always build back up and build back better. Now, those of you who listen to this, who are conservative, will say, oh, wait a minute, he's using a Biden thing. And he says it's radical. No, I didn't. The difference between a radical and Biden is like the difference between the Mississippi and the Atlantic. Both of them have water in it. Both of them have currents in it. But one is definitely larger than the other, I would think. One has bigger, broader systems and bigger, broader needs than the other. Thus, one has a bigger vision of what needs to be accomplished in it than the other does. Biden is not a radical. Biden isn't even a progressive. He's a moderate. But even moderates get to a point where they finally understand and they see that there needs to be significant change. In other words, there needs to be significant reformation. Biden is a classic liberal. He is a classic liberal. People fail to remember. Obviously, we're not taught well about this, so of course they're going to fail to remember. They didn't know it from in the beginning. So when FDR came in, FDR had support of a lot of liberals and some conservatives and a lot of progressives and a number of radicals. Why? Why? Because he understood it was time for reformation. It was time to reform. The conservatives knew that something needed to change. The liberals knew that everything that they believed should be done to try to reform without actually restructuring had been exhausted. There needed to be a restructuring with the reformation, and he was willing to do it. The radicals liked him because for once in a life, he was listening to the radicals and saying, you know something, I can't go all the way, but some of these ideas can be useful. And he moderated their ideas. He took their ideas and he moderated them and utilized them for the benefit of the society. He didn't go overboard. He didn't do as England did, which was make unemployment available almost free of charge or give the people health care. He didn't do all that, but he went as far as he was willing to go. And so even the liberals were like, yeah, we can deal with this. We can do this. Now, granted, he lost some heart midway through, tried to appease the conservatives, fell off, didn't work, yada, yada, yada. It's a heck of a story. But Biden is a moderate. He's a classic liberal. He sees that change needs to come, and he's moving towards that change. What separates him, though, from a progressive is he's only willing to go so far to actually restructure the system, whereas a progressive doesn't hesitate. They're going full-blown towards restructuring and reformation and saying, you know, I'll stop when you tell me I'm too far left. And truthfully, to be fair, a lot of progressives have that in their head where it's like, okay, I'm going a little bit too far here. You know, I'm starting to kind of get into the socialist territory, so I'm going to just halt myself. I'm going to halt myself. He's a moderate. He's always been a moderate. He's been so conservative in some points of his career that people forgot he was a Democrat. They did. Hard for me to say, but it's the truth. This is what is so frustrating and maddening, listening to these conservatives today. Trying to paint him as anything but a moderate. Trying to paint him as anything but a classic liberal moderate. He's making some changes because if he doesn't, and this is, liberals are good for this. If the changes don't come about, they're going to lose the whole game. And since they're going to lose the whole game, the society is going to start to teeter and maybe even collapse on itself. And who are they going to actually, you know, liberals like to feel important. That's one of the things that they like to do, is they like to feel important. And they like to feel like they're accomplishing something bigger than themselves. So if the society teeters and collapses, how are they going to feel that? Now, conservatives have the same problem too, or the same feeling, but theirs is more grandiose. It's more ego-driven. It's more not arrogant, because I mean, a lot of liberals can be massively arrogant. There's another word that I'm just not seeing, I'm not hearing it, but, you know, conservatives have the same thing. For conservatives, though, it comes off as not being arrogant, but being selfish. And so they become the center of everything that they're trying to accomplish. Well, if it works for me, then it must be good. If it works for people who I'm associated with, then it must be good. Forget about the fact that I'm a millionaire or I'm heading to be a millionaire. And the reason this works well for me is because it's aimed at a small group of people who are just like me, who are millionaires or more than that. And so it's not really going to help the other people. It's not really going to help folks who are making, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a year because it's not aimed for them. But I'm too in love with myself. I'm too self-centered and self-focused to understand that this is going to hurt them and not help them. Too many conservatives have that problem. Now, when Hal Sparks connected what's going on with Kevin McCartney to Trump, I went back in my mind to a not too good, but it was decent documentary from Al Jazeera. And I'm not, you know, I usually, what's funny is I used to love Al Jazeera. It's changed over the years. But this documentary, I was so excited to see it because it was supposedly telling the story of the rise of the new jihad alongside the rise of the new conservative movement in the United States. And there were some interesting bits of information in that documentary. But it wasn't that good. It didn't tackle enough of the story, but I digress. The reason I brought it up was because when Hal Sparks mentioned, you know, the connection between Trump and what's going on now, in my mind, I went back to this documentary. There is a moment in that documentary where they were talking about the Gingrich counter-revolution of 1994. The whole Contract with America saga, which swept the Republicans into power. By the way, that's not what swept the Republicans into power. It was corporate conservative or conservative corporatist. I don't know. Either way, it was corporate radio that was dedicated to this neoconservative line that swept the Republicans into power. And it has been them who keeps them in power. It is not anything but that. It was never ideas. It was always manipulation and media propaganda. But in the run-up to the election in, I think it was 92, so it was prior to Gingrich's ascent, there was a Republican, conservative Republican, who said, look, I'm for small government, but that's also why I am for a woman's right to choose. And I remember perking, like, wait, what did I just hear? And he said, I am for small government. I do not believe government should be intruding into your personal life. And the right to choose for a woman is a personal choice. They should have the right to do this because the government does not have the right to tell them not to do it. I was like, wow, wait a minute. What? Okay. He got beat. Spoiler alert, the man got beat. He did not return to Congress. Why? Because the true small government conservatives were also civil libertarians. See, this is another reason why I call these folks regressives and nihilists. They have literally taken the rhetoric of true conservatives and they have manipulated it and twisted it into something that is unrecognizable. This man was a conservative, but he was a civil libertarian. And as a old school civil libertarian, this man did not believe that the government had the right to tell a woman that she couldn't get an abortion. This wasn't a states' rights thing. This was a total government thing. The states had no further right to tell a woman that she couldn't get an abortion than the federal government had. Now, you might say to me, well, wait a minute. It's immoral. Wait, you want to tell me that a woman getting an abortion is immoral? Have you read the history of the United States? White person? Because that's typically the people who tell me that. Or folks who are, you know, penetrated by the white mind. They've gone to that sunken place. Have you read the history of the United States? You want to talk to me about morality? The reality is this. And this is just a point that I'm going to bring up about abortion and then move forward. Women were having abortions prior to Roe v. Wade being decided. The United States federal government and the state governments had a responsibility to its citizens to regulate that industry so it wouldn't harm people and it wouldn't maim them and kill them. It is the same responsibility that we expect from federal and state regulators when it comes to hospitals, when it comes to grocery stores. It is that same protective mechanism that we have inscribed in our government that we should expect them to exercise when it comes to abortions. Now, the argument that some conservatives might make is, but it's still immoral. That's according to you. That's according to you. Again, I'd read the history of the United States and then come back to me and talk to me about morality. Anyway, they have taken what true conservatism was, and they have mangled it up. Now, this has always been this strain of manipulation of pure ideas has always been in the United States body politic. Never forget, the reason the original framers of what would become the Constitution, the original reason they wanted to set up a confederacy of states was because they witnessed the savage Iroquois, their words, not mine, the savage Iroquois operating a successful confederacy, which they then worked to destroy, which was very democratic, which was very personally invigorating, which was very personally engaging and communally empowering and individually empowering. And it put all of those things together to make a very fluid body politic. The white man saw that, the white folks saw that, and said, well, the savages can do it, we can do it. And they built a confederacy hoping to show that the white man's confederacy was better than the red man's. And you know what they proved? They were too in love with power. They were too in love with power. They took an idea that was pure in form and they contorted it in such ways that they destroyed it. And they had to get rid of it. And what did they go back to? They went back to the Republic concept. Why? Because it was familiar. Thank you to the Roman Empire. It was familiar. It was the only way that they could understand power in power positions. They couldn't understand anything else. When we talk about, well, this is a democracy. The democracy of the Greeks, the Greco-democracy form, was very aristocratic. And it, in many instances, mirrored the Republican structure, especially the early Republican structure of the Roman Empire. It wasn't any different. I mean, there was subtle differences, but not too many. In fact, it was so amenable to the Roman style of governance, and I've mentioned this before, when Rome finally got sick of the problems that Greece was presenting it, it just absorbed it. They didn't have much to restructure. They absorbed it and said, okay, we're going to keep you from fighting each other, you city-states. And, you know, you get to still enjoy your wealth and stuff, but now you're just going to be part of us. They went back to what was familiar because they couldn't handle this idea that was pure. They contorted it to the point where it couldn't work. And so they went back to what they were used to, a power position structure that enabled them to hold ultimate power. This strain has been in the United States for a long time. It is nothing new. It is nothing new. This actually points back to the idea of calling them regressives. Because ultimately, the goal of these people is to take the United States way back, way, way, way back to before civil rights legislation was passed, to before women had too many rights. They still want white women to feel somewhat empowered, but not too many rights, you know? Not too many rights. They want to go back to before the federal government was involved in economy, and they want corporations to reign supreme, and this is actually very important because this is the more frightening aspect of it that is rarely ever talked about. They want the capacity to commit violence without punishment. But wait. Fire Mayor Deese, come on, man. Come on, you can't know that. They've never said that. They've never hinted at that. Really? Really? When Donald Trump was in front of a crowd of police officers, and he said, you know, you don't have to put your hand over the head to protect the subject, the suspect, should I say. He was actually painting a broader picture than what many people understood him to be painting. The idea of police officers roughing somebody up, back in the day, especially like early Law and Order and some of the shows that were on back then, Homicide Life on the Street, NYPD Blue, less NYPD Blue, I think, but definitely Homicide Life on the Street, they literally would show, you know, how police officers used to treat suspects. You know, you get ready, put them in the car. No, you don't put your hand on their head. You mistakenly bump their head pretty hard on the top of the car. Or maybe, you hip check them into the side of the car or what have you, and then you put them in and they're moaning and groaning and, hey, it was an accident. It was an accident. But even if that wasn't there, when you look at some of the conversations that have been dredged up and posted online from these Facebook chat groups and what have you, these people are constantly talking in the rhetoric of violence. They hide it. They speak in code, but it is there. It is there. It is there. And we ignore it at our own peril. Let me give you a quick scenario about something that could happen, and we need to really keep our eyes on this. Then I'm going to end this one. Let's say, by some miracle of miracles, 2024, the election of 2024, results in the Democratic Party retaking the House significantly, let's say by 20 seats. And they expand their lead in the Senate. And Joe Biden gets the White House. And then let's say 2026 comes and they buck the trend. Instead of losing seats in the House and Senate, they gain seats in the House and the Senate. You will see how dedicated these people are to peace when that happens. You will see it. You will see. Heck, you don't even have to wait. Think about the lockdowns in 2020. And think about how violent those got. Nobody was pepper sprayed, nobody was tasered, but those people were all up in the face of those police officers, and nothing was done. Violence. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. Find my work on radio4ALL.net, radio4ALL.net. Support me, PayPal, Cash App, CWB Podcast, and soon, and very soon, we are going to hear the truth. Sorry, been listening to a bit of gospel music. Anyway, soon, I am going to be finally launching. It's technically up, but I don't have anything there yet, so it's what it is. But I will be finally launching a YouTube channel dedicated wholly to Class War Battlefield Podcast. You could attempt to find it now. It's under CWB Podcast or Class War Battlefield Podcast, but mostly if you look it up on YouTube, you're going to get to my channel, and I will be publishing the link to the new channel soon. Also, if you go to radio4ALL.net, you will find, if you type in Class War Battlefield Podcast in the search bar, and then you hit enter, and then click into one of my shows, particularly the newer ones, you're going to find a list of progressive media sources at the bottom, towards the bottom, actually. And I invite you to please go through those and pick the ones that you're not familiar with, and check them out. There's actually one on there called Class Wars that's been around for a long, 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 long time. So check them out. It's a bunch of older folk who are doing amazing work. Give them your love. Check them out. They have a really good blog, too, that goes with it. But there is tons of progressive media that's really starting to climb up, and I'm going to do my part to spread the word about all of them. So I want to shout out, before I leave, Dr. Obata Shaka, Black Power Media, family at a Remix Morning Show, Dr. Karen Hunter. Who am I missing there? Oh, In Class with Carr, of course. The Professional Left Podcast, the best podcast that you still ain't listening to, and you should be. Professional Left Podcast is really a great podcast. They have three podcasts, and they're experiencing a bit of financial need to keep one of those podcasts still going. So if you can throw in some bucks for them every month, hey, throw some dollars their way, help them out. Of course, my brother Jay over at Best of the Left, Keith Olbermann, Countdown with Keith Olbermann. I actually just was watching some of his old MSNBC countdowns from 208, which, whew, what a different world that was. I've been waiting for something to happen. Oh man, there's one right on the tip of my tongue, and it's just not working its way out. Anyway, questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from y'all. I'm your brother, Vimer D. So, guy, yeah. And I'll see you on the next one, y'all. Because I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a